From the National Catholic Register, this is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
The 45th March for Life took place in Washington, D.C. last week as more than 100,000 pro-life supporters spoke out in defense of the culture of life. The march included the historic presence of the President of the United States, and the National Catholic Register was there. Pope Francis also sparked some controversy during his visit to Chile, with his remarks on the clergy sex abuse crisis earning a stern rebuke from one of his closest supporters. That's all coming up on Register Radio. I'm Matthew Bunsen, Register Senior Editor and co-host for Register Radio. Jeanette DeMello is off this week. Well, Pope Francis is always making news, but his just completed trip to Chile and Peru included a great deal of controversy as he waded into the clergy sexual abuse crisis. We're going to talk with Register Senior Editor Joan Frawley Desmond about what the Pope said and should have said. But first, a massive crowd, estimated at around 100,000, gathered in Washington, D.C. for the annual March for Life, part of a nationwide and now even global effort to speak out against abortion and the culture of death on the anniversary of the Supreme Court decision of Roe v. Wade. This year, the march was joined by Speaker of the House Paul Ryan, but all eyes were on the White House when President Trump became the first president to speak to the march via a live television feed. To fill us in about the march, we're joined by two managing editors, the National Catholic Register managing editor Tom Wehner and Catholic News Agency's managing editor Michelle Bauman La Rosa. Both attended the march, and a very warm welcome to both of you.
Thanks very much. It's good to be here.
Well, Michelle, let's start with you. How far did you have to travel to take part in the march in D.C.?
Well, I came from Denver, Colorado. I've been to both the local marches in Denver before, and also I've been several times to the National March in D.C.
And Tom?
Well, since I'm just down the road or up the road in Connecticut, we've been coming to the March for Life in D.C. for several years. A large bus of our homeschool group drives down overnight and comes back the next day after the march. So we try to make it a pilgrimage in every way. So it's really a special event.
Well, that's one of the things that's always so striking about the march, and I'd love to hear your impressions of this, that it's more than just a political movement. This is, you used the word, Tom, a pilgrimage. It seems to be something that's very important for a lot of people every year.
I would agree with that. As the march has evolved, there are more and more secondary events or events associated with the March for Life. For instance, the Mass at the Basilica, the Shrine of the Basilica of the Immaculate Conception, that drew more about 20,000 people the day of the march, and I believe there's an even larger event at the sports arena the night before. So it's the march is the capstone of the event, but there definitely it's more than the march, I think.
Yeah, and Michelle, you would agree with that?
Absolutely. And this year, of course, we had the bishops in D.C. and Arlington offering a plenary indulgence that could be gained for those who attended the march as a pilgrimage. So you saw, I think, a lot of masses and a lot of confession hours in the weeks or in the days surrounding the march as well.
Yeah, and to Tom's point regarding a lot of events taking place, how do you decide editorially, given resources and personnel, who's going to cover what, and knowing, of course, that you're not going to be able to get to everything? Michelle?
That's a really good question. We actually have several staff members in training right now out in D.C., so it was a little bit of a tossing people into the pool type of situation. We basically just had one person go to the morning mass at the Capital One Center, one person go to the evening mass at the Basilica, and then, of course, during the march, we had, you know, boots on the ground, everybody out just trying to hear people's stories, take pictures, get videos. You know, we just really had everybody at the march at that point.
Mm-hmm. And what was your favorite experience of the different events that you went to?
For me personally, I love seeing the march and hearing people's stories. You know, I was raised Catholic, I was raised pro-life, and sometimes remembering that other people have had profound conversion experiences or they've been personally affected by, you know, they themselves chose not to have an abortion because they had been touched by the lives of a pro-life witness. So I think just hearing the personal stories at the march are always my favorite.
Yeah. And Tom, what did the Register do by way of deploying those people who were going to be there?
Well, for instance, we had the luxury of, because we are affiliated, and under EWTN News, we are affiliated with CNA, so we utilized a lot of their resources, piggybacking on them for some of the coverage that we had. Prior to the event, we also inquired as to which of our many bloggers would be along the march, and we had them deployed. We had two such bloggers live blogging from the event, as well as writing afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Now, Michelle, you mentioned some of those really moving stories. What were some that jumped out that you're going to take with you when you think back on this march?
You know, one that really stuck out to me was a young woman who said that her mother had almost chosen abortion. She was in a difficult situation. Her family was not supportive of her. She was kicked out of her home when they found out that she was pregnant. But she changed her mind because of the support that she found with these pro-lifers that she said were just so joyful. And she said, if they were willing to support me and they didn't even know me, then I knew that I could do this. So then her daughter, that daughter that was born because she chose life, is now a young adult and is very active in the pro-life movement. And that just reminded me of the importance of the personal interaction. Obviously, the pro-life legislation is very, very important, but we also have to be willing to stand up and support women who are in difficult pregnancies in different ways, however we can support them materially, emotionally, spiritually.
Yeah, Tom, I know you talk to a lot of people.
Yes, one of the things that really jumps out at me is, and it's really as a parent of three adult children, along with a young adult children who accompanied my wife and I to the event, it's always heartening to see people in their 20s, late teens and 20s and 30s who have made their faith their own. And they're not going there because they're being made to by their parents. They're not going as part of a mandatory confirmation group or a mandatory youth group event. A lot of the people who I see are joyfully pro-life in every way, and they have made their faith their own, and which is a very heartening thing.
It could be a product of the fact that we're all getting a little older, but every year it seems to me that the March for Life gets younger and younger. It's kind of amazing how young the March for Life seems to be. This year I was especially struck by not just the college students, as what you're talking about, Tom, that the number of high school students and even younger than that who are there with their parents or with their schools, but as you say, by choice.
Exactly. We were in a very good position on the mall just to survey. One of the things I usually do is I just scan the crowd to see the different banners. Lots of homemade banners, lots of banners from schools, as well as, I mean, there were some groups that traveled, which gives me a good idea of the pro-life commitment. They traveled. One group came from Ave Maria, Florida, which is a day's trip, and some, you know, there are people, groups that have come from Kansas and much farther out than that. And so, you know, and it's always, you really sense a community of believers in this respect.
Mm-hmm. And Michelle, are you struck, because I know you were interviewing a lot of people, you and all of the correspondents who were there, by how articulate so many of these young people are in providing an explanation as to why they're pro-life, but also the deeper meaning of why it's important to end Roe v. Wade?
Yeah, I think overall there is a level of articulateness among some of these young people where they've really, you know, a lot of the pro-abortion argument is just an argument based on emotion, kind of slogans like women's freedom and reproductive rights. But a lot of the young people at the march really understood some of the ideas, both, you know, the science behind it, behind the basic biology of when life starts, that side of it, and then also kind of a spiritual awareness of what's going on, and that this really is a battle that's taking place in our country and in our world for the salvation of souls. And really, I think there was an impressive level of insight from some of these young people what was actually going on.
Yeah, and having the President of the United States speak to the march doesn't hurt, does it?
Absolutely, definitely. I think there was more media coverage this year than in previous years because of that.
Yeah, and it's I've even joked about it that in any other given year, having the Speaker of the House be there actually addressing the march would be memorable in itself. But this year we had basically all the three top leaders of government in the United States, because we had Donald Trump, we had Vice President Pence, and then we had Speaker Ryan. What does this say, though, politically, about the importance of this movement nationally?
Well, I think that just what Michelle said about the advances in science and the advances of what our awareness of what it means, what life truly means, I think it's reaching people after 45 years. We hope and pray that it sticks with the people who make laws, but I think that there is more of an awareness. Just by one of the speakers who struck me, who was really powerful, was the representative Jamie Herrera. Mm-hmm. Butler of Washington, who was there with her daughter, and those of us who watched it or who were there could tell that her daughter was very aware of what was going on, and because she was interrupting her mom.
Yeah, she kind of stole
way,
the show, but, didn't she?
Yeah, she did, but in a very, very good way. And sometimes when we think of politicians, we think of them as people without a conscience, people who are heartless, and even the representative from Washington was very moved when she was recounting her story about turning away from the advice of medical professionals who wanted her to abort her child, and she was there with her 4-year-old daughter who was mm-hmm. very fine.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, Michelle, we have the testimony of so many women who considered abortions but whose eyes were opened, whose hearts were turned. And it seems to me that this is one of the keys to the cause, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, not just in the United States, but internationally as well. I was also struck by how many people we saw who had come from overseas just for the march. You know, people from Europe, people from Latin America. One young woman was from Canada, and she said she had come down because she wanted to learn from the U.S. pro-life movement. She said that, you know, she was involved in the Canadian pro-life movement and really wanted to come see what the U.S. pro-life movement was like so she could take back some of that knowledge and just that approach to her work in Canada.
Right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately, but Michelle Bauman from Catholic News Agency and Tom Wehner from the National Catholic Register demonstrating how we are pooling our resources to try to provide the best coverage possible of major events in the life of the Church. Thank you both, and I look forward to having you back.
Thanks. Always
Thank
a pleasure.
You.
Well, when we come back, we're going to be joined by Register Senior Editor Joan Frawley Desmond on Pope Francis, Chile, and controversy. More when we return. This is Register Radio. I'm Matthew Bunsen.
Father Wade Menezes talks about the National Catholic Register.
As the National Catholic Register celebrates its 90th anniversary, I think that says a lot about the publication. It works. It's solidly Catholic. It presents the teachings of the Church, unabashedly so, and also guides its readers to be even more solidly Catholic themselves. One of the major effects that I think the Register has on its readers is that it elevates the intellect. Whether it be a faith item or a news item, it presents the news and the faith item in a very balanced way. One thing that the Register can never be accused of is being too far left or too far right. It is solidly Catholic, right in line with the chair of Peter, and I think that says a lot about the Register.
For a 6-issue free trial of the National Catholic Register, go to ncregister.com and click on the 6 free issue banner, or call 800-421-3230 for your 6 free issues. And as you await your first issue, enjoy some of our online content.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. I'm Matthew Bunsen, co-host of Register Radio, filling in, of course, for Jeanette DeMello, who has off this week. Well, Pope Francis just returned to the Vatican after a very hectic trip to Chile and Peru. It was also a journey filled with controversy that included a major public rebuke from one of Pope Francis's most reliable collaborators. What exactly happened? Well, to answer that question, we're joined by Joan Frawley Desmond, Register Senior Editor, and somebody I always love having on Register Radio. Welcome back, Joan.
Thank you, Matthew. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we'll get to the controversy in a second, because there's always something to talk about, it seems, especially when Pope Francis gives these in-flight press conferences. But let's start with the basics, his trip to Chile and Peru. This was a tough visit for the Pope, but why did he go in the first place?
Well, it was an apostolic visit, and so the Pope, you know, goes to express his concern and often has particular issues. For example, he placed a great emphasis on the rights and the needs of indigenous peoples, which is kind of a new, sort of fresh issue that I think hasn't gotten as much attention, and I think people found that really interesting. But there were there was a lot of controversy as well. And, you know, this part of the world, you have, you know, it was still very strongly Catholic culture, but you also have inroads of secularism and also a lot of Protestant advances. Mm-hmm. People have joined Protestant sects. The church itself at times has seemed overly complacent.
Yeah, and Chile seems to be what sort of a ground zero for the clergy sex abuse crisis, certainly in that part of the world. We have a number of controversies and cases, not just in Chile, but also in Peru. But it seemed that the one in Chile is the one that really garnered the most attention. What exactly did the Pope say or do that caused such an uproar?
It's a complicated case, Matthew, but let me, in a nutshell, try to quickly give a recap. This case has been simmering for some time. Three bishops were accused of shielding a mentor they had who later turned out, you know, it doesn't necessarily, we don't know that they knew this, but anyway, victims said that they should have known or did know that this notorious clerical abuser had done what he had done, and that they should have called him out and, you know, reported him and removed him or helped to remove him. Instead, that didn't happen, the victims say, and they blame the bishops for that. So fast forward in 2015, the Pope attempted to advance this bishop, promote him to one of these three bishops to a new position. He had been, this is Bishop Juan Barros, and that provoked huge protests, including protests from the Chilean bishops. We now know from a leaked document that was leaked just before the Pope arrived in Chile that there was an attempt, some kind of deal was done to allow for the resignation of these three bishops who were under a cloud, the resignation being kind of like a sabbatical to be reviewed after more information was known, at the very least. When that deal fell through, the Pope went ahead and appointed Barros into this more senior position. And that has been a simmering dispute ever since. Victims say he has no credibility while Barros remains in his post. And the Pope actually continued to defend this this decision. And then he really got into trouble when he said the victims, you know, were in so many words, slandering mm-hmm. the bishop or the, you know. So it's complicated, and, you know, I don't blame our readers for scratching their heads trying to understand it all. But
right.
That's it in a nutshell. And the Pope suggesting that the victims had slandered, you know, or committed calumny, then got into even more trouble because he was attacking their experience effectively. And this provoked Cardinal O'Malley to respond.
Yeah, now this, I think, took everyone a bit by surprise because Cardinal O'Malley, of course, of Boston, who's also the head of the Papal Commission on the Protection of Minors, that's Vatican office, that itself has been somewhat controversial because of the resignation of two victims from the commission. They were members. But his public rebuke of the Pope was, I wouldn't say it's unprecedented, but it was highly unusual. But I was especially taken aback by Pope Francis's response to that. So all of this just added more layers of complexity, but also really got everybody's attention much more than it might have, right?
Yeah, I thought the Pope's response, of course, was sounded tone deaf. You know, he's had 5 years now to become more attuned to the issues there. Perhaps he didn't know a lot about these issues previously, but the need for sensitivity, and, you know, victims have been told in the past so many times, you know, we don't have any evidence. This can't be true. Everybody thinks this person's great. How could this be? So, yes, actual court cases may be different, but for a Pope to just sort of sweep aside this in such a way as to raise questions about their own credibility, the victim's credibility, because there's no question that the original abuser did what he did. The question is whether the bishop shields him. So, you know, unfortunately, we may never know the answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
The Pope also made a very spirited defense for the need for innocence when there isn't hard proof. And while I think people who have been critical of zero-tolerance reforms as occasionally, affecting innocent priests, This wasn't the way to do it, for sure.
Right. And the pressure seemed especially to be there because of the use of language. People don't always differentiate the idea of proof versus evidence. And at times, would you say that we have done not a great job at times in communicating the progress that has been made in the clergy sexual abuse crisis? And an event like this really overshadows much of the good that has been accomplished.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it can really raise questions about the credibility of Vatican reforms, which you can be sure someone like Cardinal O'Malley, who's worked so hard on this issue, both back in Boston, he also had responsibility for other dioceses. And, you know, I think it's unlikely anyone knows more or has invested more in winning back victims and helping them know that the suffering that they went through, you know, at least some good will come of it to protect other children. So, yeah, I think it must have been very disheartening for him. And the fact that he opted to make this statement, I mean, he is one of the Pope's closest allies. He's a member of his Council of Cardinals. And he is the most trusted voice in the U.S., no doubt, on clergy abuse issues. So for him to kind of draw a line in the sand was very striking.
Mm-hmm. And for Pope Francis to come out very quickly and try to apologize, I was struck also by Pope Francis's use of language in terms of apologizing to those who might have been hurt by his comments. Is it safe to say that the Vatican Communications Wing is getting better at dealing with a crisis like this? Because in the past, we've seen a situation like this linger for a couple of days as pressure built even more so from the mainstream media.
Yeah, it's a good question, Matthew, and I don't really have the answer to that. I was looking at all these issues in the past week, and I think it's still very much a steep learning curve for the mm-hmm. Holy Father, as we've seen, but also for the Vatican. And to be fair, sometimes these, you know, abuse cases involve very sensitive information. It's not always clear what can be released. And then with the lack of information, which has certainly happened, or delayed responses to controversies like this in the past, then you get into media coverage that can be, you know, misleading, inaccurate, and then that does its own damage and can be hard to repair.
Yeah, so in your view, having looked at this very closely and reporting on it, and I know we're going to have an editorial about this in the upcoming issue of the Register, where do you think this is headed? And do you think that enough was done in this particular instance to repair some of the damage?
Well, I think everyone hopes that one thing that happened is to put the Holy Father on notice that unscripted comments on sensitive issues in particular is a big mistake. And we saw Cardinal O'Malley's very precise, clear language, you know, that was structured. It had, you know, he made the point first to victims. He echoed their own experience of not being believed. He affirmed his support and pastoral care for them. He said the Holy Father does care about this issue, whatever people might think, judging by the headlines. And, you know, he showed that the Holy See is still committed to this. But I think people are going to be watching more and more to see what's going to happen next. And, you know, moving back to Rome and leaving Latin America, what people are looking at are a number of very important issues. Among them is the future of O'Malley's commission, the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors. It's been allowed to lapse. It's supposed to start up again this year, but it's not clear when. I've heard different dates, but I don't have anything hard and fast. That's one issue. Another proposal by the commission for a tribunal to try bishops accused of negligence or abuse, that was scrapped. Some say they don't need it, that the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith can handle these cases, and perhaps that's the case. I know the CDF has moved ahead with the investigation and trials of bishops, but mm-hmm. these are questions that remain in doubt, and
yep.
I think people are watching to see what happens.
They are. Well, Joan, thank you so much for your time, for giving us this update, and I look forward to continuing this conversation with you.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Matthew.
Well, thanks so much for tuning in to Register Radio this week. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us. I'm Matthew Bunsen on behalf of Jeanette DeMello and our producer, Jeff Burson. Until next week, God bless.
For
more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.